I want to welcome you to week two of our series out of the book of Philippians called Live in Light. And this series is all about living in light of what Jesus has done. And so we're going to pick up right where we left off last week. I'm going to be rolling through verses 12 through 26 of chapter 1. And while you're turning there, I have a question I'd like you to ask yourself while we get started today. And it's this: how do you define life? And I guess more specifically, what I'm after is I'd like you to get in your mind, I'd like you to ask yourself the question: how do you define your life? Or on what do you define your life? What we're going to see in this text is Paul going through an incredible amount. But what you're also going to see is that how we define life has incredibly, incredibly far-reaching effects on the way that we live. So I'm just going to read right through 12 through 26 and we'll get started. Paul says, "Now I want you to know, brothers, that what's happened to me has actually resulted in the advance of the gospel, so that it's become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to everyone else that my imprisonment is in the cause of Christ. Most of the brothers in the Lord have gained confidence from my imprisonment and dare even more to speak the message fearlessly. To be sure, some preach Christ out of envy and strife, but others out of goodwill. These do so out of love, knowing that I am appointed for the defense of the gospel. The others proclaim Christ out of rivalry, not sincerely, seeking to cause me anxiety in my imprisonment. What does it matter? Just in every way, whether out of false motives or true, Christ is proclaimed. And in this I rejoice, yes, and I will rejoice, because I know this will lead to my deliverance through your prayers and help from the Spirit of Jesus Christ. My eager expectation and hope is that I will not be ashamed about anything, but that now as always, with all boldness, Christ will be highly honored in my body, whether by life or by death. For me, living is Christ and dying is gain. Now, if I live on in the flesh, this means fruitful work for me, and I don't know which one I should choose. I'm pressured by both. I have the desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better, but to remain in the flesh is more necessary for you. Since I'm persuaded of this, I know that I will remain and continue with all of you for your progress and joy in the faith, so that because of me, your confidence may grow in Jesus Christ when I come to you again." So I want to talk about three things today, even though this is only going to be a two-point sermon, a little light on the points today. I want to talk about what was going on in Paul's life prior to and during the time that he was writing this text to the people of Philippi. And I want to talk about what he knew that got him through his hardship and how he knew it and how you and I could know it. Sound good? Well, like it or not, that's what we're doing. So let's get rolling. So the first thing that Paul says here in verse 12, he's talking about what has happened to him. And he says, "I want you to know, brothers, that what's happened to me." So the first thing that you and I really need to understand if we want to really get inside of what Paul is trying to talk about here is just looking at what went on in Paul's life. And Paul was dealt a really rough hand for several years prior to writing this letter. And even during the time that he was writing it, things really only went from bad to worse. So if you were here with us for our series called The Roots, when we rolled through Acts, you'll know the last several chapters of the book of Acts kind of tell us what Paul was dealing with after his third and final missionary journey. And so what happened was Paul was in the temple in Jerusalem, and some Jews from Asia were there. Paul had a very bad reputation among a lot of Jewish people. And so they started lying about him. They said that he brought Greeks into the temple, which was actually a crime punishable by death. And that's exactly what they tried to do. So a mob basically grabbed Paul, drug him out of the temple, was getting ready to kill him before the Romans intervened and kind of, you know, scooped him up and brought him into custody. And that's where Paul was. He was in Roman custody while they were kind of trying to decipher what was going on, and who's right and who's wrong and why everybody's so fired up. And so Paul winds up, it's a very bureaucratic process, but Paul winds up getting moved from Jerusalem to Caesarea. He stands before, the Sanhedrin and various governmental authorities. He kind of keeps getting punted up the chain of command. It's very clear everybody knew that he was an innocent man. But then we read that a guy named Felix, after Paul was already in prison for 2 years, just kind of left him there because he didn't want to upset the Jewish people who really wanted to see Paul dead. So now there's a change of administration. He's got to make his defense, all over again. Like I said, it was very bureaucratic. He's wasting time. All of this was because of false charges. And so eventually, Paul just says, enough's enough, and he appeals to Caesar, which is what Roman citizens could do. So Paul gets placed on a boat with 275 other prisoners, and they set sail across the Mediterranean on their way to Rome. And that's where things go from bad to considerably worse, because they were in the sea really late in the year, which meant there were storms that got pretty violent. And so, you know, this really, really nasty storm kind of overtakes them. It blots out the sky. They can't see the stars. They can't navigate. The wind's blowing the boat. So they're really not, they're way off course. They're not even sure where they are. The waves are beating this ship so badly that they all thought they were going to die. They're lashing the ship, which literally meant tying it together. They throw the cargo overboard because they're convinced, like, this is basically it for them. And then they finally crash land on an island called Malta. So they have a shipwreck. And just when you think, like, that was the end of Paul's woes, then he's warming himself up by a bonfire, and lo and behold, gets bit by a snake. The old, my life's falling apart, and then I get bit by a snake routine. So bad to worse for Paul, and which I have to believe would have probably been just it for me, but he persevered. And then he gets on to Rome. So this has taken probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 years or so of, you know, being punted around in the prison system and, you know, false accusation, all that kind of stuff. That's what's been going on prior to him even getting to Rome. But what he tells us in verses 12 through 26 is what was going on in his life while he was actually writing this letter. And it's really three things. Paul says, number one, he's locked up. Not only is he locked up, though, he's chained to a Roman soldier. So this is, you know, a total loss of dignity, a total loss of privacy. Every hour of the day, he's chained to a Roman soldier, meaning, like, literally can't use the bathroom without this guy literally, within arm's reach of him and you know, kind of looking over his shoulder. So that would have been miserable. Then on top of that, he says that there's a lot of people in the Christian community who, for some reason, really didn't like Paul. We don't really know why. But they were kind of preaching despite Paul. So people were kind of trying to capitalize on his hardship. And then, you know, this is the hat trick. This is the third thing. He's got the ever-present reality that every day could be his last day, because he's going to stand trial before a human ruler who has a stupid amount of authority. And so, you know, humans all do the same thing when they get a lot of authority. They abuse it. So Paul knows that every day could be his last. So the question that I'm asking myself as I've been studying that this week, I'd like you to ask yourself the same question, is how would you respond if that's where your life was? Now, I'm willing to bet there's a number of people in here that are dealing with some very serious things. I'm willing to bet that because I know that for a fact. Some of you have talked to me, but I'm convinced that there's a lot of people here today that are dealing with things extremely heavy, maybe you haven't told anybody about. But regardless of what you're going through, I think, I really don't think there's anybody that would want to trade places with Paul in a first century Roman prison, waiting every day to find out if he's going to be executed for crimes that he didn't commit. The unbelievable thing about Paul, though, and you kind of see this really when you look at the life that the guy lived and you study what he dealt with and all of his persecutions and sufferings. What's unbelievable about the guy is he was kind of unbreakable. And I think that's really commendable, because that's exactly what suffering has a tendency to do to people. Usually if you apply enough pressure to somebody, if you apply enough suffering to somebody's life, what it'll inevitably do is break them. And people tend to break in the face of suffering in one of two ways. You can either break very irreligiously, or you can break very religiously. And I guarantee you, as I walk through this, you know people that have done both, and maybe you've even, you know, you've been at one end of the spectrum yourself. So for people who break irreligiously in the face of suffering, what they do is they begin to hate God, basically. An example of that, I used to be friends with a guy about a decade ago. His name was Chris, and Chris told me kind of, when we were actually friends, he was a professed atheist. He pretty much stopped believing in God, and he explained why. He said that, he used to be a Christian, used to go to a choir of the fire, used to go to youth group, used to cry over his faith and all that stuff, and bore all the outward signs that you would expect of, someone claiming to be a Christian. But then his parents went through what was a really tumultuous breakup. It really sort of left him with some scars to bear and some baggage to carry around. And so as a result of that suffering, of that hardship, Chris just kind of broke. And from that moment on, he turned on God. He was angry at God. He began to hate God. But not everybody breaks that way. The other way that's really common in the face of suffering to break, you don't break irreligiously, you break religiously. And these people in the face of suffering, they don't hate God. They don't turn on God. They just believe that God hates them. And so what you'll do is you'll look at your life and you'll see that, you know, things are being taken from you or you're kind of falling apart at the seams, and you'll kind of whip yourself on the back and beat yourself up, and you'll just run through life convincing yourself that you would have a better life and you wouldn't be experiencing all the trials, all the hardship, all the pain, all the suffering if you just prayed more or if you just worked harder or if you just served more or if you could somehow earn God's love. And so what you're really telling yourself is that, you know, that God hates you and that's why you've been dealt the hand that you've been dealt in life. The vast majority of people, if you apply enough pressure to their life, they're going to begin to go down one of these roads. And it almost sounds like one of them's better than the other, but they're actually both incredibly destructive, because what they have in common is that the person suffering and the person breaking is getting further and further and further away from God. But again, what's amazing about Paul is that it didn't have any of those effects on him. Matter of fact, you know, when you read 12 through 26, you look at what the guy's dealing with and you hear what it has to say, it's kind of ridiculous the amount of endurance that Paul has, because he basically says, yeah, I could live or die, but I'm not really sure which one I'd prefer. Like, he actually says that, you know, I'm kind of pressured by both. I can see pros or cons either way. I guess it would be better for you guys if I lived a little bit longer. I would rather die, but I'll probably stick around for your benefit. So what you see in Paul's life is, you know, he's lost several years of his life. Really, the people that he was trying to preach to are the people that turned on him. Like, this guy, according to a lot of people's estimation, has a number of reasons to get bitter or to get calloused or to give up. But instead, he's always got gas in the tank for whatever reason. So what I wanted to walk through at the beginning of this teaching is basically show you how significant it is that Paul could endure a lot of suffering. But frankly, and I do like to be frank, who cares? Because it's not helping me on Monday morning at 11:30 when my life's falling apart to know, boy, that Paul was a great guy, amen? I'm just being honest. So what I wanted to do with this teaching, I'm gonna lob a two-pointer at you guys. Only 2 points to remember, so you better. And what I want to look at is, number one, what Paul knew that allowed him to salvage really his sanity in the midst of all of these things going on in his life, this, you know, circus of problems. And after we look at what he knew, what I want to look at is why, or rather, how he was able to know it, and then sort of drive that home in your and my life. Sound good? Yeah, all right. The first service didn't say anything, so I was like, well, we're doing it anyway. So here's the first thing. This is my first point that Paul knew that we see explicitly in his writing. Point number one, Paul knew that God was the ultimate alchemist, which is not incredibly clear at first. But let me read this, and I'll explain what I mean. And I'll roll through 12 through 19 there. I kind of put the highlights on the board there. But I'll read this. He says, I want you to know that what's happened to me, this circus of problems, this absolute nightmare of a life, he said, all of it has actually resulted in the advance of the gospel. That's an optimist if I've ever heard one. He says, so that it's become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to everyone else that my imprisonment's in the cause of Christ. He says in verse 14, he says, most of the brothers in the Lord have gained confidence from my imprisonment and dare even more to speak the message fearlessly. And he goes on and he says, yes, some people are preaching the gospel with wrong motives, but he says in verse 18, what does it matter? Just that in every way, whether out of false motives or true, Christ is proclaimed, and in this I rejoice. Yes, and I will rejoice because I know this will lead to my deliverance. So God's the ultimate alchemist. Paul knew this. Now, what alchemy was, it was a ridiculous pseudoscience in the Middle Ages in which people were trying to find a process to turn lead into gold. Lead they perceived to be totally useless. Gold they knew to be very valuable. And so they were trying to take something that seemed useless and make it actually very useful, very valuable. What Paul is saying in these verses is that God is absolutely the ultimate alchemist. And Paul was very versed in the Old Testament. And I think one of the clearest examples of this truth, God working alchemy in a seemingly useless situation, is the story of Joseph. If you teleport with me back to Genesis, and Joseph's an incredible story. Joseph, the story starts off, he's betrayed by all of his brothers because his dad really loved him a whole lot more than the other brothers. Insert joke here about me and my brother. I'm not going to do it. You can just use your imagination. So his dad made him a coat of many colors, and his brothers burned with jealousy and said, man, I want a coat like that. So they threw him into slavery in Egypt. Bit of an overreaction by my estimation, but that's what they decided to do. So again, like, think about the way that suffering breaks. And, you know, we hear these stories. Hop in the driver's seat of Joseph's life real quick and ask yourself, if all your brothers sold you into slavery in a foreign nation, I think you might be a little bitter. All right, we got some honesty in the crowd today. So Joseph could have broke one way or the other, could have started getting angry at God, could have believed that God was angry at him, but you don't see that. And so what happens is Joseph is, he's actually repeatedly pursued by a married woman in Egypt, which, you know, seems backwards, but evidently, you know, Joseph was a looker. And so after repeated advances, Joseph keeps shutting this woman down. And again, like what you'd expect to see, maybe Joseph would just cave and say, you know what? Doing the right thing hasn't gotten me anywhere, so I think I'm just going to do whatever I feel like doing. But the guy had too much character for that, too much integrity. So he, you know, he kind of gives her the stiff arm to the point that she's kind of trying to, like, grab his and, you know, take his clothes off, and he just, you know, bolts out of the room. And so he did the right thing despite all the hardship that he'd suffered. But then what happens? Then the lady lies and says, wait a minute, Joseph was coming on to me, and who are they going to believe? The upstanding Egyptian citizen or the foreign slave. So Joseph gets locked up for standing his ground, for refusing to cave in. And so again, I'm reading that story. You know, we hear this all our lives, but think about, man, if your life just consistently, I mean, maybe that's where you're coming from. Maybe you feel like your life is going from, like, a place of difficulty to greater difficulty, and you keep trying to do the right thing, but God just refuses to honor that or refuses to, you know, kind of bail you out. I'm sure that's how Joseph would have felt. But what becomes very clear is that it's in prison that a gift that God had given Joseph begins to be put on display. And that gift, of course, was that he could interpret dreams. So Joseph starts interpreting dreams. He gets noticed. He gets out of prison. He interprets an incredibly important dream that told him that there was going to be 7 years of plenty, where the land would produce like never before, that was going to be followed directly by 7 years of famine. And so Joseph winds up climbing the ranks in the Egyptian government. He's second in command. He's an incredible administrator. So what he does is he stockpiles food in Egypt while the land was producing for the time when it wasn't. And so during this time of famine, there's basically like untold numbers of thousands or millions of people that are coming to Joseph's feet that really Joseph has the ability to save. And lo and behold, who shows up at his sandals one day except his brothers? And so his brothers don't recognize him, but of course he recognizes them. And, Joseph already had a proven track record of character. So by this time in the story, you know he's not going to execute him. You know he's not going to treat him unfairly, because that's not the kind of guy he is. And sure enough, he winds up saving his brothers. And what's so cool about that story, first off, no one wants to be a Joseph, at least not during, you know, the first several chapters of that life. But of course, everybody wants to be Joseph at the end. What's incredible about that story, and like the great irony of it, and rest assured, the Bible is, there's so much irony in especially Hebraic narrative in the Bible. But what's so ironic about it is that Joseph actually needed to be betrayed by his family if he wanted to save him. Right, because let's run the scenario where God gives Joseph this easy, cushy, comfortable, problem-free life that we all think we want, myself included. And what would have happened is no one would have known that this famine was going to strike the land. So Egypt would have never stockpiled food like they did. So Joseph and his family would have starved to death. And God had bigger, better plans for that. It just looked really useless. It looked non-redeemable, really, until the end there. And so Paul, in his situation, knowing God to be the ultimate alchemist, is really looking for God to do the same in his life. And I'm convinced that when you and I begin to look for God to turn our situation into gold, we begin to be more sensitive and begin to really see him doing that. And this is explicitly what the same author here, same guy, Paul said in Romans when he makes one of the most, really like kind of one of the most audacious promises the Bible makes, when we're told that all things, I know you know this one, all, just think about this, all things work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to his purposes. Meaning that God is so brilliant, God's wisdom is so perfect, and God's power is so unstoppable that he doesn't need to give his people totally good lives in order to create something at the end that is totally undeniably good. God can take even bad things in our lives and somehow create something that's good at the end. And I was just talking to my buddy about this week, and I'm like, it's not even that I think I've had a really hard life, because I haven't. It's just that I think a lot of things in my life aren't that significant. But what that verse is promising is that everything's going to work together for something that's like, it'll almost take your breath away. And I think when we get into eternity, when we stand before God, we're going to see, man, his hand was on me the entire time. And the only requirement was that I keep his eyes on him, and he'd take care of everything else. So look at what Paul's really saying here in his situation. And, you know, he's locked up and he's chained to these Roman soldiers. But the way that Paul saw it, it's not so much that he was chained to these Roman soldiers as it was that they were chained to him, right? Like, think about that. He's got these, like, war-beaten, carved out of marble Roman, like, nasty dudes. Like, they're not really soft. I don't picture them really, you know, breaking down at the preaching of the gospel into a puddle of tears. Probably not people that Paul was going to have a terrible amount of influence over, you know, as a drive-by evangelist. But now these guys literally can't escape Paul, and they can't kill him until, you know, the guy upstairs says, you're allowed to kill him now. So all he's doing is, I don't mean this the wrong way, but beating him down with the gospel, like, all the time, because Paul, like to evangelize, from what I gather in the Bible. So sure enough, they start dropping like flies and, you know, turning to God. So what God was doing, what Paul saw God doing in this situation, was basically changing the Roman governmental system from the inside out, because these people can't get away from the most persuasive evangelist that's ever walked the planet. And then in addition to that, he's saying, yeah, you know, a lot of people are kind of spurred on. They're encouraged. They're inspired to preach the gospel even more fearlessly. And he says, and, you know, for some reason, there's a lot of people out there that are doing it despite me, to try to cause me anxiety. But Paul had the wisdom to just drop back and say, I don't really care as long as the message is getting out there. You guys can try to, you know, preach despite me, or because you don't like me, or you're trying to compete with me. But who cares? Because, you know, finally people are doing what they were supposed to do. And so, you know, Paul could just drop back and say, hey, this is a win all around. But that's not the only thing that Paul saw here, and that's not the only alchemy that God was performing, because it's absolutely true that God can work alchemy in our situations, but Paul saw something even deeper. He saw a second kind of alchemy that God was working, and that's not where he turns situations into gold, but where he turns his people into gold in their situations. You follow me there? And so what he says, yes, and I will rejoice because I know this will lead to my deliverance. I underline that word, which means it has to be important. That word for deliverance, it's interesting that it was translated that way, because that word is a Greek word that the Bible usually translates salvation. And I'm guessing that the commentators, they didn't translate it salvation, because that would seem kind of strange if Paul said, this will lead to my salvation, because of course Paul was already a Christian when he was in prison. The reason that he used that word is because the Bible talks about salvation really in three tenses. There's the past, there's the present, and there's the future. So whenever you and I, when we called, you know, the first time that we did it, when we legitimately put our trust in Jesus Christ and we asked Jesus to forgive us of our sins and, you know, dedicated our life to him, in the past tense, we were saved. And in being saved, what that really means is we were saved from the punishment of sin. Which means, hey, we might have consequences this side of eternity, but when we stand before God, there's no wrath, there's no disappointment, there's no anything except, well done, my good and faithful servant, enter in and rest forever. Good news? That's the first tense. That's the past tense. The second one is a present tense that the Bible talks about. We're being saved. Paul says the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but for us who are being saved. And so in that sense, we're not being saved from the punishment of sin, because we already were. What we're doing is we're being saved from the power of sin. And so it's this work that we would call sanctification, where we're being made more like Jesus Christ, which, hallelujah, I'm not the finished product. We're being made more like Jesus Christ. He's not done with us. And then the future tense is the day that, you know, we were singing about in worship. This is when we will be saved, not from the punishment or the power of sin, but from the presence of sin altogether. When we'll have a new body, we won't have a sin nature, we won't be fighting, you know, this spiritual schizophrenia where we're doing what we don't want to do and not doing what we want to do. And, you know, Paul really laid that out in Romans 6. Point being, what we're living for is the day when there's no more struggles and the environment that we're living in is totally free from the stain of sin. That's worth reminding ourselves about, yeah? So what Paul's saying here is that he knows that God is an alchemist, not just in his situation, but in his own life. And Paul rooted himself in the knowledge that God had custom made and custom fitted this type of suffering, this hardship, this path that he carved out for his man Paul in order to make him the man that he wanted him to be. And so Paul could really just drop back and relax and say, hey, this doesn't move God off the throne an inch. For me, because Paul knew, hey, I'm not moved an inch from where God wants me to be, and his providence reigns all over my life. So you don't have to raise your hand, but wouldn't it be nice if you could go through life like that? Like, wouldn't it be nice if the check engine light isn't what it took to kind of derail you for a week, or a couple of bills that you weren't expecting to pay in the mail? And yeah, I use that because those two things really bother me, and maybe you're something like me. Like, wouldn't it be nice to kind of be, like, bulletproof? Because so far what I've told you is, you know, Paul experienced a lot of suffering, but he knew that God was the ultimate alchemist. But I can tell you, tomorrow morning at 11:30 a.m., when your life still has problems, and it will, I don't think it's going to do you a ton of good if you say, God's the ultimate alchemist. Thanks, Ryan. That makes a lot of sense. So the question that this raises for me, because I can know that intellectually, right? And it's not enough to just be able to reiterate that. My question when I was reading this is, how was Paul able to know this? How was Paul able to be as rooted as he was? And that question is answered very clearly, very plainly, very profoundly by one of the most memorable verses in the Bible found in this dialogue right here. It's Philippians chapter 1, verse 21, where Paul says, "For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain." And so what Paul knew is my second and final point today. Let's throw that up there. Here's what Paul knew. Paul knew how we define life determines how we live. And so Paul was basically saying, hey, my life has been an absolute train wreck on the outside looking in, but it doesn't bother me at all. And if I don't make it out of this, that actually works out for my good. What Paul is saying with this verse right here, he is explaining the secret to his buoyancy. He's explaining how he was so bulletproof. He's basically telling you the root of his endurance, and it all boiled down to Paul's definition of life. When he said, for me, living is Christ, what he's saying is, for me, the reason that I can stay in this storm and not be moved by this storm is because Jesus is my life. Now, let me explain, in case it's not abundantly clear, how important this is. And rest assured, everybody in this room, everybody with vital signs, is defining their lives with something. Amen? Let me explain what I mean, and I'll give you a couple of examples. This is a really common one in our culture. We're very much into appearance and image and things like status and things like that. So for a lot of people, their life is their reputation. Or think about that. So really what they're saying, I don't care what blank they would fill in or what, you know, answer they would write down on the test, their life is wrapped up in their reputation. Now the way that this breaks down is essentially this means you have to appear perfect to people all the time. Miserable, exhausting way to live. You got to look perfect, or you can't look like you have any problems. You can't ever let your guards down. You can't admit failure in any regard, because if you do, it's like a catastrophic failure. Criticism, things like that, they eat you alive. They dissolve you. They corrode you, because your life is your reputation. All right, another one that's incredibly common in our culture is appearance. We are incredibly materialistic. We are incredibly into appearances. And so for a lot of people, you see this all the time, their life is their appearance. That's where their life is wrapped up in. And consider for a moment, because it's so easy when you live in a culture like ours to just normalize everything that we do, but just consider for a moment how crazy this actually is. So what are the, celebrities are obviously the richest people in our culture. What do celebrities, which are really, you know, kings and queens, what are they spending their fortunes on? I mean, really, what it boils down, like people will spend literally as much money as they can on their appearance. I mean, honestly, if it's surgeries, if it's injections, if it's body modification, and think about, like, I was thinking about this week, and it got weirder to me the more that I thought about it. You can watch TV for almost any length of time, specifically if you see an infomercial, and inevitably you will see a product that you are guaranteed will defy the aging process. So for all of the questions that forces me to ask, why is that even a good thing? Like, why would we want to fight against the aging process? Because what I was also considering this week, here we go. Anybody here real proud of their yearbook photos? Anybody? We got one man. That's because that's Dave Porter. But none of you look as good as Dave Porter does. I don't. But I look back at my yearbook photos, and bottom line, I'm trying to put some space between those photos and the present day, because if memory serves, my wife didn't want anything to do with me in high school. Not that I'm bitter. Not that we fight about it all the time. Not that it's keeping me up at night, but point being, the point that I'm trying to make here is obvious. You know, for people that are defining their life by their appearance, when their beauty begins to fade or when they begin to bear signs of aging, it's literally like their life is slipping away. It's literally, you know, if they don't look good, then all of a sudden there's no reason to live anymore. That's absurd. Or, you know, for some people, if you're a millennial, this is probably gets a little bit closer home to you. I'm not judging. I'm a millennial, I'm told. The one that, you know, really defines that generation is the idea that you're nobody until you're loved by somebody. So think about, like, all of the codependency that's, like, really been on the rise where, you know, a guy knows a girl for 30 minutes and he's texting her that he needs her and he can't go on without her in his life. And then they break up and he spirals into this never-ending chaos of oblivion. And it's because your whole life was resting on that individual. Your life was defined by that relationship. Or this would be my last one, but this one was really interesting to me. I was watching a show the other day, and it was a bunch of grown men trying to make it on a professional football team. And so I was watching the final episode, at the end of the episode, it got really tense, and it was almost like lambs being led to the slaughter. My wife actually could not watch this with me because, you know, she felt too bad for him, so I turned it up. Oh, jeez. So, no, but they're all sitting in the locker room. That's not funny. They're all sitting in the locker room. Anybody got a place to stay for like a couple of week or so? So they're sitting in the locker room, and they're getting called in one by one. And you really do feel bad for them. And they're getting called into the head coach's office. And then, you know, for the vast majority of them, they get clipped because obviously playing sports professionally is incredibly difficult. And the chance of failing infinitely higher than succeeding. So a lot of them are hearing the worst news that they can imagine. That what they've been working for since, you know, some of these guys since they could walk is not going to be a reality. And so they were interviewing some of these guys, and one of this guy, he was saying he's been cut before a number of times, and he was explaining that, you know, how painful it was. And he was saying, you know, the last time I got cut, he said, you know, I cried a lot and, you know, really tough to bounce back. But then he said something that really caught my attention. He said that he stopped feeding himself for a while. I heard, it's funny here listening to an audience respond because I just heard someone go, what? That's kind of what I thought, whoever that was. So I'm thinking, all right, now I get football is fun to play. And I get, you know, football is fun to watch. But a human being, I mean, football is a game that some human being invented one time, right? Like God didn't say, let there be football. Some of you might argue with that, but he didn't. You can read Genesis all you want. My point is, this is a game. This is a game that we're talking about. And this guy couldn't play this game on this team that he wanted to play, so he stopped feeding himself. So here, let me bottom line this here. I don't care what that individual tells me their life is defined by. Their life is defined by football. And how they fill in that blank right there, what he would say is, for me, living is playing football. Here's the problem with that. Here's the problem with that. There's a lot of problems with that, but here's the main one. If that's what you're defining your life by, then what happens when you get cut from the team? If that's what you're defining your life by, what happens if you make the team, but then you get a career-ending injury? I'll tell you what happens. It's not just that football's over, it's that your life is over. You see how important this is? You see why how we define life determines how we live? It determines everything about us. It determines what we serve, what we worship, what destroys us, what we give the ability to destroy us. But if we can say with Paul that living is Christ, that Jesus is life, what happens in that moment is that nothing can harm us. Because the moment that you can say that Jesus is my life is the same moment that you can say that dying is gain. In that moment, nothing can be taken from you. One concept I've always found like endlessly interesting to me in the Bible, so profound, it's actually in Romans, same author, Paul. He actually sort of, and follow me here, this is going to sound really weird, he actually kind of highlights the fact that human freedom is it's an illusion. Now, I'm not saying that we don't have free will. Follow me here. Paul tells Christians in Romans that once we were slaves to sin, but then he says, but now you're slaves to righteousness. Interesting to me, like very interesting to me, that he doesn't say you once were slaves to sin and now you're free. So what the Bible is saying is that we're serving something either way. We're a slave either way. And so the only question is who your master is. Follow me? So here's why I go down that road. If any of the things that I talked about earlier and all the things that I didn't have time to get into, if it's your job, if it's your career, if it's success, if it's status, if it's appearance, whatever it is, if any of those things are your definition of life, then rest assured that thing is your master. Meaning you will make sacrifices with that goal in mind. You'll spend your money with that goal in mind. You'll spend your time with that goal in mind. You'll spend your life with that goal in mind. Like think about, and hear me. I hope you don't hear me saying that there's anything wrong with, you know, toning up or if there's, you know, anything wrong with playing football. That's not my point. But when it becomes your life, in that moment, it becomes your master. Think about somebody who can say that like football is life. There's like a limitless amount of possibilities and opportunities that they said no to for the sake of pursuing what they're defining their life by. And the illusion that captivates so many people is that we're in the driver's seat in that scenario, because we're not. Because whatever is at the center of our heart's affections, whatever we're defining life by, really, we're not in control of that. It's in control of us. It's dictating how we live our life. It's dictating the choices that we make. And so, listen to me. Maybe you're here and you're skeptical about Christianity. If you are, and you're debating, man, am I ready to give up my freedom for Jesus? You've already given up your freedom. It's just a question of who you want your master to be. And what the Bible screams on every single page is that Jesus is a better master. He's an infinitely better master. Because here's the thing. If you serve any other master, you know what's going to happen? You're going to be lied to by that master. You're going to be manipulated. You're going to be deceived. You're going to be eventually bankrupted and left with nothing to show for it at the hands of that master, because it doesn't love you. It doesn't care for you. But Jesus is the one master that's an exception to that rule, because not only does he not work his people to death, he came down here to die for us so that we could live. Amen? And so here's the logical conclusion of Christianity, and this is high-level theology. This is not a switch that you flip, and it's certainly not something that I claim to have nailed down. But what only Christianity allows someone to say, they can say with honesty, when Jesus is their life, they can say, listen to me, it doesn't matter if everything in my life falls apart, because everything in my life is not my life. My life is Jesus. And that can't be taken from you. That's good news, yeah? Let me call the worship team up and kind of wind this thing down. Maybe you're here and you've experienced, you know, some degree of suffering. And, you know, it seems like, you know, you're on the verge of losing hope, and you got questions that are bigger than your answers and all that kind of stuff. This might be difficult for you to hear. And this is, I don't want this to sound like a pat answer, because I don't think it is. But let me just offer you this. Maybe what seems like your undoing could actually be like the greatest thing that ever happened to you. I used to watch this show called Intervention. And in the show, they would follow somebody that was struggling with an addiction. And the crescendo of every show would be when the friends and family members who really loved this individual got around them and they had an intervention. And the purpose of an intervention is relatively, it's simple and profound at the same time. What they're trying to do is show this person that they so love and so care about how dangerous the road that they're on actually is, and really how bad things are, and how much better their life could be if they just let go of what is holding on to them. I say that, and I say this with kind of like almost awestruck. The way that the Bible describes you and I and everybody who's ever dared to turn oxygen into carbon dioxide, it tells us that we're all addicts. We're all addicted to something. We're all addicted to sin. It's not something we can just, you know, put away and be perfect all of a sudden. If you could, we'd all do that, but we can't. And so the only question is what really our drug of choice is. Here's what I know in the bottom of my heart. God uses suffering like an intervention for his people. Let me say it again. God will use suffering like an intervention for his people. Because what suffering does is it shows you what master you're really serving. It shows you what your heart is really wrapped around. It shows you what you're really defining life by. And God will use suffering to show you how false of a way of life that is, how fake of a way of life that is, and he will show you how much better a way of life there is if you'll let go of what you're holding on to with a white-knuckle grip and hold on to Jesus instead. Because nothing reveals where your heart is like suffering. And maybe some of you are here today and you've broken exactly the way I said suffering can break you. Maybe you're angry at God. Maybe it's because of something recent. Maybe it's because of something decades ago that you're still not recovered from. Or maybe it's not that you're angry at God. You've just put a great deal of distance between you and God because you think he's angry at you. Let me tell you, I believe that God will custom design suffering for his saints to show us what we're holding on to, what we're defining life by, so that we can let go of that cancer, that poison, that toxin, and hold on to Jesus. And so my charge to you closing today, don't let suffering be an end for you. Let it be a beginning. And rewire your heart in the midst of suffering and hold on to Jesus. Define your life by Jesus, because the moment that you can say that Jesus is life, absolutely nothing can touch you. Amen? That's it. That's all.